Most of you listening right now are voters. But voter turnout is not what it should be for a democracy like this. How do we increase voter turnout in this country? How do we revitalize democracy? We'll talk about that this hour with our guest. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, June the 19th. And we are happy to have with us the author of a new book, A Return to Common Sense, 7 Bold Ways to Revitalize Democracy. We will welcome your ideas, too, at 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Michael Waldman is a former White House speechwriter for Bill Clinton, current executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice, and author of A Return to Common Sense, 7 Bold Ways to Revitalize Democracy. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why does our democracy need revitalizing in the first place?
Well, the thing we see in this exciting election year really brings it all into sharp relief. In so many ways, this is a time when there is a surge of public engagement and involvement, many more people voting, more people giving small contributions through the Internet. We all see the ways in which this is a year that has engaged people politically. But in very fundamental ways, our democracy is broken. The systems of our democracy and our government are broken. And that's one of the reasons that policy is so hard to change, and one of the reasons that the country is headed in the wrong direction. We have the most burdensome voter registration rules among Western democracies, according to former President Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter when they studied it. It's one of the reasons we have consistently had the lowest voter participation rates among those democracies, or right near the bottom. We have the craziest campaign finance laws around, where people running for office wind up spending most of their time fundraising very often. The number of lobbyists in Washington, D.C. has tripled in the past 10 years. All these things and many more, you know, these are not new. They've been the background noise of American life for a long time, but they've kind of compounded. They really are going to be an obstacle to change. And so if people want the moves for change and reform that we hear in this election year, when Barack Obama is running on change and John McCain is running on reform, that's kind of a rare confluence. Yeah. We want that energy of 2008 to translate into change and reform in 2009, that we've got to fix the systems of government to make it possible.
Yeah. Well, I do want to go through your seven steps to revitalize democracy one by one, since they're all important. You want to end voter registration as we know it. You mentioned that we have a burdensome voter registration system. What's so burdensome about it?
Well, this system was created about 100 years ago or so, basically to keep former slaves and Irish immigrants from voting at the time. And it's obviously gotten better, and many more people can vote, but it still leaves up to 50 million eligible citizens off the rolls. Now, sometimes that's because people don't want to vote, you know, or whatever. They're not interested. But a lot of times it's because someone moves from place to place, or their forms are lost, there are bureaucratic errors. Voting should be something citizens take seriously. It's I think, kind of all of our duty to do it, but government should not get in the way. And we now have the ability, for the first time, because of computerized lists that were created statewide by a recent law, we now have the ability for states to simply be the ones who keep the lists. When you register once, when you turn 18, you're registered forever. And then what would happen is politicians, instead of slicing and dicing the electorate into narrow bands, they would realize that, you know, everybody might show up. And they would wind up, I think, at least I certainly hope, aiming their campaigns at a much wider group of people. Part of any reform like this, I should mention, should be something that has been tried successfully in 8 states, which is Election Day registration.
Mm-hmm. Basically, Wisconsin's one of them.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which is, as you know, when you show up, election day. If you're not registered, you can register and vote. And that you'd need that as a kind of, in case the lists are, you know, in case there's a mistake on the list. But all these things taken together, it's just should be easy right now for government to do in this country what it does in every other country, which is simply make it that everybody who's an adult who's a citizen can vote.
Yeah, some would say, though, then it's also easier to commit fraud.
Well, you know, the whole issue of voter fraud is actually, I think, somewhat separate in the sense that who's eligible to vote is different from what whether you need to show ID or something like that when you show up to vote. Now, any positive changes on voting has been hit on the head, on the back of the head, by this argument that there's widespread voter fraud. And instead of trying to find ways to make it easier for people to vote, unfortunately, a lot of people are trying to find ways to make it harder for people to vote. They say that there's voter fraud. And every study that has taken a serious look at it, including a number by my organization, the Brennan Center for Justice, and we're part of NYU Law School in New York, has found that the kind of voter fraud that any kind of an ID requirement would stop is basically non-existent in this country. And your odds of committing voter fraud are less than your odds of getting struck by lightning. And this, you know, this after years where the United States Justice Department spent a lot of energy trying to prosecute voter fraud and not finding any. And you remember that when a number of very honest U.S. attorneys around the country said, hey, we can't find the voter fraud, they were fired for not bringing partisan prosecutions. This whole voter fraud argument is something of a myth, and it is really designed, I would suggest, not because of a real desire to stop voter fraud. You could find all kinds of ways, you know, if you really wanted some way to make it so that everybody was who they said they were, which of course we all want, you could say that people could bring all different, lots of different kinds of ID to the polls, or they have the way they do it in Michigan is you have to bring a driver's license or some other government ID. But if you don't have it, you can sign an affidavit sworn at the polls. You go to jail if you're lying, saying I am who I say I am, and you know that works fine. But the kind of government ID requirements or proof of citizenship requirements that people come up with because of the supposed problem of fraud, those keep many people from voting.
Yeah, but in any case, you're saying that if we do end the voter registration as we know it and have this you know, same day or a poll sign up for voter registration, that would be an important step to increasing voter participation.
We could add up to 50 million American citizens, eligible voters, to the rolls and keep them there. And that would be a major improvement in American democracy. And that's the first of the ways to revitalize democracy that I talk about in A Return to Common Sense.
Yeah, and the second is fix electronic voting to make sure that those voters have their votes counted.
That seems like a common sense idea.
Mm-hmm.
One that, you know, this book, the title is borrowed from Tom Paine, and his great pamphlet, Common Sense, that helped start the American Revolution. And this book isn't really much longer than a pamphlet. But I don't think Tom Paine had a position on electronic voting. I'm willing to wager that. You know, since the debacle in Florida in 2000 when they couldn't figure out how to count the votes, the whole country pretty much has moved toward electronic voting. And a lot of people have been worried, gee, these machines, are they safe? Can they be hacked? And we convened a bunch of computer scientists from the federal government, from private business universities to look at it, and they concluded that every one of these electronic systems, in fact, is vulnerable. I like to say that when it comes to voting, even paranoids have enemies, as the old joke goes. Every one of these systems is vulnerable. That's the bad news. The good news is there are ways to fix it so that if you have paper records, a receipt, basically, so that the voter can see how their vote was registered. You ban wireless components, and very important, you need to have audits so that to make sure that the machines are registering even the way the paper records show. If you do those things, you can really make them much more secure. Unfortunately, very few states have done all the things they need to do. So that's another thing we need to do to make sure that votes are counted properly?
Well, there are the first two steps to revitalize democracy, according to our guest this hour. And we will talk about the other five, and we will welcome your ideas, too. How do you think we should change things to increase voter participation and have a better working democracy? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn with you after 9 o'clock, talking with her guest about the economic impact that the recent floods are having on the Midwest agriculture industry. That's coming up after 9. We're talking about voting and democracy and what we can do to revitalize our democracy. Our guest is Michael Waldman. He's a former White House speechwriter for Bill Clinton. He's also the current executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice, and he is the author of A Return to Common Sense, 7 Bold Ways to Revitalize Democracy. And we have an email from Gerald in Tomahawk, who says, you can register all the people you want, but how do you get them to go to the polls? Election Day should be a public holiday. What do you say, Michael Waldman?
I say that's idea number 3 in the book. I think that he's got a very good point. Again, we don't make it, a lot of the people, according to the United States government, which surveyed this, a lot of the people who don't vote, it's because they have to work. And it's very hard, actually, to get off several hours from work for a lot of people to vote. Now, you say, why do we have Election Day on the first Tuesday in November? Is it in the Constitution? Many people assume it must be. It was a law passed in 1845 because back then, voting was done at the county seat. The Sabbath was on Sunday. You needed a day to ride your buggy to the county seat, and market day was Wednesday, so it had to be Tuesday. And it had to be in November because that was where it fit into the agricultural cycle. So it was done for convenience, to make it so that more people could vote. And we could do all kinds of things, like what your listener suggests, make Election Day a holiday. Although, you know, a lot of people have to work on holidays, and it's often the people who work, you know, in menial the jobs are not the people who don't get off on a holiday, or the people who wouldn't get off from work job holiday for Election Day, or making Election Day 2 days, or allowing vote by mail and absentee voting. Some places in Oregon they have only vote by mail. I don't really like that, but there are a lot of different things you can do to make Election Day work better. All those things taken together, fix electronic voting, universal voter registration, make Election Day actually convenient and a holiday, that would really dramatically change how we run voting in this country. But then we have to change how we run politics in this country.
And we'll talk more about that after we get in a couple more about voting. Karen in Salem.
I've got to get through all 7, you know.
Yeah, Karen in Salem Township.
Hi there. I would like to know what your guest how your guest feels about possibly just making it a law that you have to vote. Don't some countries actually do that?
Yes, believe it or not, they do. Belgium and Australia, which are not totalitarian societies, do that. Although I guess Australia was started as a penal colony, so maybe they have less of a libertarian streak than we do. I think there's a very strong argument, actually, for requiring that people vote. People show up at the polls to vote. We have to pay taxes. We have to serve on a jury. I do think it's a duty of our citizenship. I'll tell you honestly, we have such a strong and ornery libertarian streak in this country that I don't think it's likely politically that you could ever persuade people to do that. So I don't talk about it too much in the book.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about a statistic I was just given by my previous guest on this program, a political scientist from Wisconsin, who says that Wisconsin's voter turnout in the last presidential election was 77%. That's not bad, is it?
No, it's not. It's getting up there. Wisconsin is highly unusual, though, in the country. Most places are lower. Wisconsin has the progressive tradition. And look, this year there's a likelihood that there will be a surge of new voters, and many local officials are very worried that they will not be able to actually handle the increase in voting, that people will show up. And as has happened, for example, in Ohio in 2004, you saw people in poor neighborhoods having to stand 10 hours or 11 hours in the rain online to vote. And that didn't happen in suburban neighborhoods. And when you have that kind of slipshod management of elections, you really are disenfranchising people, and none of us want that.
Yeah. Kurt in Alloway, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I thought we should have mobile polling places, kind of like the ice cream truck. It would drive through your neighborhood and stop at each block, and people could just come out of their houses and vote. Make it a lot easier for the elderly, and if you just heard the truck pull up and you could just come out and vote, it wouldn't be as hard.
Kurt, are you serious?
Sure, why not? I mean, wouldn't that make it a lot easier? You wouldn't have to make, you know, you wouldn't have to find someone to watch your kids. You could just go right out and vote right there.
Mm-hmm. Well, think about it. I hadn't heard that idea, mm-hmm. but it's an interesting one. I wouldn't have that be the only way to vote. But in what jingle would the trucks use? if they played Happy Days or Here Again, that would be a problem. That would be for the Democrats.
Oh, yeah.
I think the real point that the caller is making is we actually can make it so that people can vote not next to their home. In other words, I love going to my local elementary school and going in there, but in fact, I work all day in an office several miles away. And why can't I go to a polling place there? If we had everything linked by computers, and if we had the government, as I suggested at the beginning, making a voter registration list that included everybody, then it would be very simple to walk in and tap into the screen where you live, and it tells you what your candidate choices are, and you cast your vote. And that is something that is technically possible. If you want to think about it, it's the difference between an ATM and having to go to the local bank in your neighborhood to see the teller to cash the check. You know, it is 2008, and we ought to be able to make it easy for people to vote. And again, it ought not be an obstacle course. People ought to do their duty and vote, but government should make it easier, not harder.
We have one more call on voting. I know you have your book is in three sections. It's fixing the vote and fixing politics, and then fixing government and the executive branch. And I'm trying to go a little bit in order with the callers. James and Amory has one more call about fixing the vote. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. Oh, my comment and / question is I don't understand why this electronic voting is such a problem in this day and age. You know, we can put a man on the moon. We can, you know, we have incredible computer systems that can run just about anything. Seems to me that counting votes would be as simple as a calculator, 1 + 1 = 2 on up. And then also with the paper ballots, you know, it's a big controversy. You don't buy French fries, and you can get a paper receipt for that. It just seems to me there's probably some foul play or something going on why this is a continual problem, and you don't see a solution until a couple more elections get past us.
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is one where I certainly agree with what the caller says. This is one where I suspect that disorganization and incompetence rather than malevolence probably is the major factor. After the Florida recount and the craziness of what happened in 2000, Congress passed a law called the Help America Vote Act. And what it did, one of the things it did, was to basically push the states quickly to move to electronic voting. This was going to be a panacea. And the people who do this stuff, local officials, they're not computer experts. Think of the average age of a poll worker. When you go to a polling place, it's very often very public-spirited senior citizens. And we pushed all these states and these local counties to buy these machines. The federal government provided some money, but not enough. And then all of a sudden, there are all kinds of problems, as really is often the case with the introduction of any new technology. And, you know, I like to use the analogy. When I turn on my computer and there's a message there from Microsoft that says, you have a security risk, you know, do you want us to fix it? And I click yes, and down comes the security patch. Well, what we've basically done with these local officials is to say, you have a security risk. Now you fix it. Tell us how you do. And so I think that there was a law that almost passed Congress last year called the Holt Bill that would have required states to move in the right direction. And unfortunately, it was the local officials themselves who blocked it. So we need to say to the people who run these elections, you know, we should all want everybody to trust these results. And this turns out this is not a partisan issue. The federal legislation was sponsored by Republicans and Democrats together. Nobody wants the other side to be able to hack an election. It doesn't make sense that we haven't been able to do better. But things are, there is some improvement as people become more aware of the problem.
Yeah, all right. So we've covered some of these bold steps to fix the vote and voter registration as we know it, fix electronic voting and the electronic voting problems, and have holidays or other ideas to increase voter turnout. Then you want to do some reforming of politics. And let me have you react to Tom in Wausau, who also agrees with that. He says, our government will not be fixed until control is taken away from corporate and other special interests. That cannot be done until the campaign finance system is taken away from corporations and other special interests and put into the exclusive use and control of those entitled to vote.
Well, I believe that the campaign finance system is a major obstacle to effective government. It is one of the major reasons for gridlock. It is one of the major reasons that public policy tilts as much as it does toward special interests, toward the wealthy, as your writer suggests. And, you know, the system is crazy right now. We've got candidates spending much of their time, sometimes most of their time, raising money rather than talking to voters. They're raising that money overwhelmingly from big interests. And then they're taking the money and turning it over to broadcasters for TV time that, again, is provided free in other countries or subsidized. And the excitement that we feel, and I certainly feel this, about the way Barack Obama has raised the money for his campaign is quite something. You know, he has raised hundreds of millions of dollars in small contributions on the Internet from millions of people, and that is a huge deal, and it may be the greatest ray of hope in this area that there is. But let's be honest, in Congress, they're still raising the money the old-fashioned way. Only 10% of the money for congressional campaigns comes from small contributions. And so I do agree that we should have public financing, not because you're going to always get all the corporate money out of politics, you're not, but because if we can create a system, voluntary system, where candidates don't have to chase the money and they can talk directly to the voters. Public financing has worked in a number of states that have tried it, such as Arizona, Maine, New York City. These are all very different places. And it really worked pretty well when we had it for the presidential system for about 30 years. It's more or less fallen apart now. So I think congressional campaigns should be publicly financed. And I actually think that we ought to there's a strong bill that Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois and Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania have introduced to do just that. But I think we really ought to think creatively about how to tap this small donor revolution. If we had matching funds for small contributions, which is how they do it in the public financing system in New York. In New York, if you give a small contribution, it's matched 4-1. So that if I give $50 to a candidate for mayor, it becomes $250. And suddenly, in the world of politics, that's real money. If we did that, we could, again, push the politicians toward grassroots organizing and mobilization as their fundraising strategy, and that also would change politics quite a lot.
Let me ask you about McCain-Feingold. How come that didn't help the situation?
Well, it did. It did. It just didn't solve the whole problem, nor did it really pretend to. And I should say that, as I mentioned in this book, A Return to Common Sense, my organization, the Brennan Center for Justice, we were one of the lawyers before the Supreme Court who defended the McCain-Feingold law. That, you know, what McCain-Feingold did was it ended the soft money, which was the very, very big unregulated contributions, basically, by which mostly corporations, also unions and individuals, evaded the federal campaign finance laws. They just was kind of slushing around. And McCain-Feingold stopped that. And that's one of the reasons that the political parties and candidates, too, are focused as much as they are on these small individual contributors. So it helped push things in the right direction. But now we've got to take the next step. And one thing, of course, as your listeners probably know, the Supreme Court comes in with a red pen and feels free to edit all the laws that Congress passes in this area. The Supreme Court just poked a huge loophole in McCain-Feingold. So we're worried there's going to be a lot of kind of phony issue ads this election, in thanks to the Wisconsin Right to Life case,
mm-hmm.
which you know started in Wisconsin. But there's a lot of work to do on campaign finance.
Yeah, that was that case was Wisconsin Right to Life. I thought it had freedom of speech allowed it to spend this money to do these issue ads.
What it basically said, what McCain-Feingold, what the law had said was that, and it was partly based on a study by my organization, that in the years before the law was passed, there were hundreds of millions of dollars in ads that were really campaign ads that pretended to be issue ads that said, you know, Congressman Smith is a jerk and he's bad and he wants to dump toxic waste or this or that. Give him a call and tell him how you feel, running the weekend before the election.
Mm-hmm.
And what the law said was if it was, you know, 60 days before an election, an ad like that is basically a campaign ad. And the Supreme Court at first upheld that, and then they got a new justice or two on the court, and it was a 5-4 decision, and suddenly it became a 4-5 decision, and the court changed its mind. So campaign finance, you know, the people in politics know that that is a battlefield that will determine many things about how this country is governed, and we've got to keep at it. It's a long slog, but the answer should not be to try to minutely regulate every piece of money in the system. But if we can create a public financing system that makes it possible for politicians to not have to be shilling for money all the time, that's the best we should do.
Mm-hmm. Mike in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I guess I have a strong disagreement with your guest. Government financing campaigns just disproves this whole concept of grassroots organizations and true local support. If your local, you know, if your neighbors and friends support you, they will give you money. They have the government finance, and it's interesting how public financing is always pushed by one party. That is not a solution. That is, frankly, a concept of helping one party. Your guest talks about corporations. What about the influence of unions? I've not yet heard him say that he's opposed to the influence that unions have in the political process and in corrupting campaigns.
Well, I actually did, but maybe you weren't able to hear it. But as to whether it's partisan, first of all, public financing was proposed and pushed first by President Roosevelt, that is Theodore Roosevelt, the Republican President Roosevelt, and it was an idea pushed by Republicans as well as Democrats, and it would affect unions as well as corporations. And I think that the caller makes a interesting point about there's a value in, you know, local citizens organizing for their candidate. And again, as I said, I think if you look at how it works in some of the ways public financing is done in New York City, that is exactly what the system amplifies. The problem is that if you've got people at a fish fry or a backyard barbecue giving middle class people giving contributions, that can be overwhelmed by the money raised by lobbyists on K Street or in unions or whatever in Washington D.C. And so, if we had a system of matching funds for these small contributions, I suspect your caller would be quite pleased by the result. It would give, you know, conservative and liberal candidates a chance to go to the folks and really organize and not always have to worry about what this lobbying group or what that lobbying group says.
Yeah. Dan in Partyville, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Waldman. I completely agree with all of your recommendations, but Republicans are against anything that gets more poor people and minorities to the polls. Why? Because Republicans support policies that help the wealthy and the well-off. They spent a huge effort in this state last election to pass a voter ID law, which we don't need. I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Well, you know, it's one of the tough things with these issues is that because it's politics, of course, there's a lot of politics in politics.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that a lot of these reforms in this book really don't break down on party lines. The electronic voting, even campaign finance, believe me, the Democrats and Republicans mostly act as incumbents on this rather than as liberals or conservatives. I was the policy aide in the Bill Clinton White House who worked on these issues. And at that time, it was the Democrats in Congress who killed campaign finance reform. The Republicans wanted to kill it, too, but the Democrats got to it first. But it is true that that this past year or this past few years, you've seen a fairly concerted push to disenfranchise people. And unfortunately, it is used as a partisan tool mostly at this point by Republicans. There was a newspaper interview with the Houston Chronicle in which, a couple of years ago in which the political director of the Republican Party of Texas said, voter fraud? There's no voter fraud. We know that. But the response to charges of voter fraud, meaning voter ID, that depresses legitimate Democratic turnout by enough to add 3 points to the Republican total. He actually said that on the record to a newspaper reporter. I said, whatever he's drinking, that's what I want. You know, so I view these issues in a way. This is about democracy. This is about the strength and future of the country. This shouldn't be partisan. Unfortunately, not everybody got the memo.
We are we're going to need to take a short pause, and when we return, we're going to talk about the remaining steps that our guest says we need to revitalize our democracy. We will talk about ending partisan gerrymandering, ending the Electoral College, and curbing the imperial presidency, and fixing Congress, too. So those steps still to come, and your questions and thoughts at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Michael Waldman is the author of A Return to Common Sense, 7 Bold Ways to Revitalize Democracy. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned and join Kathleen Dunn and her guests as they talk about the recent floods and the effect that's having on the Midwest's agriculture industry. That's coming up in our next hour. We're talking about ways to revitalize democracy with our guest, Michael Waldman. He is the executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice, former White House speechwriter for Bill Clinton, and the author of the new book, A Return to Common Sense, which has these 7 steps he thinks are needed to revitalize democracy, which we've been talking about all hour. Still have a few to go. End partisan gerrymandering. Those are the lines drawn for various congressional districts. Michael Waldman, what's the problem there?
Well, and believe me that this one is something the Democrats and the Republicans both don't like. It's just the voters who like it. The United States is unusual in having the legislative lines changed every 10 years and having the legislators themselves draw the lines. And not surprisingly, perhaps, they draw the lines to keep themselves in office. It's called gerrymandering. It's as old as the country. You know, I discovered that in the first election to Congress, Patrick Henry drew a congressional district to try to keep James Madison from going to Congress. So I think we can't pretend that this is something entirely new. But with computers, it's a lot easier to draw the lines in a way to guarantee that no one will ever be disturbed by a competitive election. And in recent years, the elections have been less competitive than ever. And that's one of the reasons, many political scientists believe, for the intense partisan polarization in Congress, because you basically don't have people worrying about the middle. They know that their only risk is a primary in their own party. And so what is the answer? Well, it's not so easy because it's not clear exactly what is the right set of goals with the way we draw these districts. But what we can do is improve the process. In Iowa and Arizona, you've got a system where they have a commission basically set up that draws the lines. It's not in the hands of the legislators. And guess what? They have more competitive elections. So we can move forward with this. And the reality is the census is coming up in just a few years. It's going to be tough to get much change in this area done in time to affect this election. But at the very least, we should not have what they call mid-decade redistricting, which is basically when a party, you know, when one party changes hands and suddenly the legislature is controlled by a different party, then suddenly they redistrict everything. That's what happened in Texas in 2004. The Republicans there won the legislature, so they redistricted. And the year before that, it had been Pennsylvania and Georgia, and it's really both parties.
Yeah, I know Wisconsin, there is a bill in the legislature to establish one of those commissions like Iowa, but it didn't get anywhere this year. How about ending the Electoral College? So just depend on the popular vote and forget about those electors?
I certainly would like to see that. It would change politics also in this country.
Yeah, but don't just big states get paid attention to and not the little states?
Well, right now it's not big states or little states that get paid attention to. It's swing states. If you live in a small state like Rhode Island that's all Democratic, or a big state that's like Texas, say, that's all Republican, you don't get any candidates and or any campaigning. And it's quite – there's a map in the book showing in the last 5 weeks of the 2004 election where Bush and Cheney and Kerry and Edwards went and where they spent a penny of money for advertising. And it's basically 15 states. The rest of the country didn't have a presidential election. Wisconsin, often is a swing state, but many, many, many other places are not. And the solution here, and by the way, of course, that's in a year where it works well. Four times, obviously, most recently, in 2000, four times in the country's history, the person who came in second got to be president. And it almost happened in 2004. Kerry lost to Bush by 2 million votes in the popular vote. But if 60,000 votes had switched in Ohio, Kerry would have been president. And I don't think a lot of people would have found that legitimate. So you could pass a constitutional amendment, which is very hard. But there's another system called national popular vote. Which is very clever, and what it is it's basically an agreement among the states that they will a state will sign up and say, we agree to cast our electoral votes for whoever wins the national popular vote, as long as enough other states do the same thing so that that person wins. And you've got Illinois and New Jersey and Maryland have signed up, and other states are moving toward it, one more state. The legislature in California passed it. Again, this is not... By far, this is not a partisan thing. What this would do, again, is make it so that candidates campaign all over the country, not just in the interstate between Columbus and Cleveland in Ohio.
Moving on to the last step, curb the imperial presidency, and Bill in East Troy will give us his thoughts on that. Hi, Bill.
Yes, hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I had a question. How can you rein in an increasingly muscle-bound executive branch of the government who almost hints that because the Pentagon is under their control, they can have criminals like Rove and Cheney deny subpoenas by the Congress? And then we can also have the imperial president right now developing a treaty in Iraq, only he doesn't call it a treaty, he calls it an agreement, to avoid the Senate review.
Right.
I think if we don't move quickly, these precedents will essentially set up a permanent imperial president. And if the Congress doesn't go along, they just simply surround it with Pentagon troops.
Yeah, you're concerned along those lines too, Michael Waldman?
Well, I do think that after we... You know, after we look at how to restore voting and how to fix politics through political reform, the caller is exactly right. Checks and balances have gotten way out of whack in this country. And, you know, it's not unusual in American history that after a crisis or war or whatever, power surges to the presidency. And all presidents love power and they want to get as much as they can. That's not that unusual. Usually, though, there's a backlash, and it's time for the backlash. And what is unusual about what's happened with Bush and Cheney is not the powers they've claimed, but the theory under which they've claimed it, which is very dangerous, very scary. They say that the power of the president is not because it's a crisis, not because it's an emergency, but because the Constitution somehow gives the president unlimited power and the ability to avoid the law, because if he alone thinks there's a threat to national security. And it's basically, as Dick Cheney himself said when he was a congressman, it is the monarchical prerogatives of the presidency that he's trying to defend. As if we didn't have a revolution precisely to keep King George III from wielding those monarchical prerogatives in an unaccountable way. So the caller is exactly right. Some of the things we have to do involve the law. We need to restore habeas corpus. Thank goodness the Supreme Court stepped up to the plate again. But Congress needs to pass laws doing that. We need to end the practice of what's called extraordinary rendition, which is basically where our government kidnaps people and sends them to countries for torture. There are a lot of things that the law has to do. There are things that the next president has to do to renounce some of these powers, basically, through executive orders. But a lot of it has to be done by the Congress, with us, the people pushing the Congress. You know, I don't think the caller said that, you know, the troops from the Pentagon would surround Capitol Hill and force Congress to give in to the president. I don't think they need many troops for that. Congress has been supine and has given up much of its power. Now, during the period when you had unified control between the legislature and the executive of one party, oversight just basically stopped. Literally, there was no oversight and no effective checks and balances. So one thing that I think we ought to think of is ways to restore oversight, regardless of which party is in the White House or regardless of which party is in Congress.
Yeah. How would you be able to do that?
Well, one way would be to say that the minority party gets to hold some hearings and call some witnesses, even if they don't have the gavel. That's how it's done in countries like Germany, where they have some experience of why it's important to protect the rights of minorities. More modern legislatures have that. And, for many years, it was the strong sense of independence on the part of Congress, even among Democrats, with a Democratic president. I didn't like it very much all the time when I was working in the White House, but it is better for the country to have Congress view its role not just as partisan rubber stamp, but as a co-equal branch of government. So it's not only the president who has to change, it's not only the laws that have to change. We have to demand that Congress step up to its role.
Yeah. Paul in Monona, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I agree with all your points, but I was hoping you'd talk about another point, and that is that politics is now a profession, a very powerful and lucrative and attractive profession to some people, and I think they would do whatever they can to keep that power, whether it's on the federal level or the state level. And, you know, I think that that's it's not a service, it's really a profession for a lot of people, and they can amass lots of power and basically have contacts and a job for, you know, mm-hmm. being in industry or that they've helped, you know, for the rest of their life. And, you know, it's a crazy idea, but, you know, to bring across my point, what if politics and serving in government was like jury duty, then you wouldn't have, you know, to tinker around with all these things to try to catch after, you know, these people who are really working hard to keep themselves going.
Interesting idea. I haven't heard that before. Michael Waldman?
Well, you know, I have a somewhat more benevolent view of the people in politics probably than you do, than the caller does, because I see the sacrifices that people have to make to run for office is just the most grueling and awful experience you can imagine. And while it's true they raise a lot of money, you know, many of these folks could be making more money in the private sector. Now, the part of the problem is, I think that it's not that the politicians themselves are more venal or more professionalized, for that matter, but that the system they're in forces them into ethically challenged situations all the time. And then you do have this very professionalized culture now in Washington where, as I said, the number of lobbyists has tripled, and an astonishing number of members of Congress become lobbyists, stay in Washington to become lobbyists after they leave office. And you now have this phenomenon, which is really unheard of, where people who get elected to Congress resign in the middle of their term to become lobbyists. This former Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert did that. And you had the congressman who was named Billy Tozan from Louisiana, who was the person who pushed through the pharmaceutical industry's drug bill, and then in the middle of the term resigned to become the head of their lobbying association. I think it's that revolving door. It's the professionalization of what happens after that in politics that really bothers me. So again, I think what we need to try to do is boost participation in every way. We're not going to get money out of politics. What we can do is boost participation through voting, boost participation in the campaign finance system so that the politicians are responsible to the public and not just to the people with the checkbooks. Make it so that every vote counts in the Electoral College so that it's not just a handful of states where there are presidential elections. And all these things, they all work together to create a system where everybody has an interest in participating, and then we won't worry as much about, you know, the politicians being professionals.
Yeah. What if we, in our final moments, Michael Waldman, what happens if our leaders don't follow your prescription here for a revitalized democracy?
In the off chance that they don't. I'm very worried. I said at the beginning that I thought this was a very exciting and hopeful year, that there was a great surge of public interest, that you have two presidential candidates. You know, Barack Obama started out as a voting rights lawyer and in Congress passed a bipartisan ethics bill. John McCain was the sponsor of bipartisan campaign finance reform legislation. You have two candidates who, more than is often the case, seem to, at some level, get the idea that the systems of decision-making really matter. But if we don't make these changes, if we don't focus on this, if we don't demand of candidates that they tell us where they stand on this stuff, then I really think there's a strong chance that next year, whoever's the president, whoever's the Congress, the change that people want simply isn't going to happen. We want health care reform. Well, unless you change the power balance in Washington, you're not going to easily overcome all the lobbies that have stopped it from happening before. We want to have climate change legislation. It's very hard. This system does not work well at making choices that involve short-term pain for long-term gain. Climate change, health care, a fair tax system, whatever it is you want, is going to be much harder unless we fix the systems.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Michael Waldman is the author of A Return to Common Sense, Seven Bold Ways to Revitalize Democracy. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, Cynthia Schuster, and Rob Ferret for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.